ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here. Coming up on the Country Hour, you'll hear about tax changes announced in the federal budget that could affect farmers, including the stripping back of the instant asset write-off scheme. You'll also hear from champion shearer Daniel McIntyre, who's on his way to Scotland to compete at the Golden Shears World Championships. And we'll check in with farmers around the state about how much rain they've had for the week and what it means. And let me know how much you've measured at your place. Get in touch on the text line 0467 842 722 or give me a call on 1300 594 222. First up though, let's head to rural news with Emma Field.
G'day Angus, making rural news. Parts of the Ukraine could be facing years without access to irrigation after the destruction of a dam, which is likely to affect millions of hectares of farmland. The dam burst on Tuesday and is near a major river, which is on the front line between Ukrainian and Russian-controlled territory. Russia and Ukraine are blaming each other for the destruction. The World Health Organization is also warning that cholera could spread in the flood-hit areas. Ukraine's agriculture minister says there will be no water in the region's irrigation system for years, and at least 500,000 hectares will be left without irrigation and be turned into deserts. Other farmland across the nation will also be affected. Ukraine is a major grain exporter, and Australian-based Rabobank analyst Dennis Voznesensky says the uncertainty and scale of the disaster could impact grain markets.
I think it's more of the fear of the unknown as opposed to something being impacted that would fundamentally change how much supply can come out of Ukraine. So, for example, all the ports that are part of the grain deal are further west, so they weren't impacted by this for now. But if you look at some of the grain storage sites, they were. And also an important thing to keep in mind is that while in normal times, in non-war times, the area that is now flooded was, of course, used for cropping, a significant amount of it, and it was very productive. Because of the war, less of that would have actually been currently in use. So I think that the market's more concerned about the fear of unknown. What are the possible further implications that are going to unravel from this? For example, there was also the ammonia pipeline that was damaged. It seems like the pipeline was quite far away from here, so maybe it was a different situation just around the same time. But the ammonia pipeline is quite important because it's meant to be part of the grain deal. So if Russia can't restart the pipeline, they said, well, we don't want to be part of the grain deal anymore. They won't allow Ukraine to export. So there's kind of a few moving parts here.
The floodwaters have put 40,000 people at risk, but you mentioned that's also agricultural land. It's summer in Europe. Would there be any wheat crops damaged?
There may be some, but I think just because the area has been under fighting or war conditions ever since the war in Ukraine started, the impact would be less now compared to if this happened when there wasn't a war going on. The other important thing to keep in mind is the longer-term implications of this. From what I understand, there's a lot of irrigated land there, and the flooding just destroys a lot of that infrastructure. So thinking longer-term, this has really significant implications.
Back home to South Australia now, where the state government will chip in $9.3 million towards the rollout of mandatory electronic ID tags in sheep. While Victoria already has the electronic sheep tagging system, other state and federal governments have been struggling to work out a cost-sharing arrangement after a national agreement to implement the system. South Australia's Primary Industries Minister, Claire Scriven, says they will contribute towards the necessary sale yard infrastructure upgrades and subsidise the cost of tags for farmers.
That will comprise of a 75% subsidy across the supply chain for essential infrastructure, as well as a 50% subsidy for producers in terms of actually purchasing the tags. So what that means in terms of the tags is that producers won't be paying more than a dollar per tag. And that was a really important thing, is the feedback that I have from industry. Livestock SA has been advocating very, very hard that it needs to be under a dollar per tag. And so that's what we've been able to achieve with this announcement. The initial subsidy is for the first 2 years, and it is indeed for new lambs and kids. What I'll be doing is working further with industry to look at the implementation for 2027.
An Australian climate scientist says it's difficult to predict exactly what impact a newly declared El Nino weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean will have in Australia. US authorities have confirmed the natural weather event has begun and is likely to bring above average temperatures later this year across the world. Australia's Bureau of Meteorology is yet to declare an El Nino, but earlier this week it said there's a 70% chance of it forming in the coming months. Dr. Andrea Tarshito from the University of New South Wales Climate Change Research Centre says it's too early to predict if the weather pattern will deliver moderate or extreme conditions.
All of the eastern parts of Australia, so northern areas all the way to Victoria, generally experiences dry conditions. But there is quite a different ways that this can manifest.
And Angus, have you ever wanted to be a coconut farmer? Well, in the Northern Territory, Humpty Doo coconut farmer Hee Yung Ung Kim explains he farms the tropical fruit on 5 acres, and it has its dangers. But he loves growing a product that's healthy and delicious.
Oh, I'm cutting coconut, yeah.
What's the risk of having a coconut come down and land on your head?
No, when I collect, I do have a helmet. Yeah, helmet. And I sing the first, second year and third year twice, but in not on my head. When I see it, I just hang it out from my head.
You swat it from the air away from your head?
Yeah, like a volleyball. You know when you see the coming and you just do like that, they go away.
So you're not afraid of getting hit on the head by a coconut then?
No.
And how many coconuts do you have here?
142 coconuts.
And how hard is it to cut them? Can you describe how you do it?
I think not hard because I have like 15 years for experience coconut cutting.
And what do you like about growing coconuts?
Oh, I think the good coconut, it's good, you know, people drinking and make healthy, you know, and clean kidney for good health, you know.
What's the interest and demand for your coconuts?
Oh, I think because the coconut everybody like.
And that wraps up Rural News.
Thanks, Emma. How funny was that, blokes? That the mental image of swatting away coconuts like they're a volleyball. Thanks for that. On the text line, Kevin says, "Good afternoon, Angus. 9 mils overnight at Myrtleford. That brings Kevin up to 51 mils for the week." Kevin says, "Have a good weekend. You too." Leo says, "G'day, Angus. Another 25.5 mils fell at Gundowring overnight. Now the total for the event is 84.5 mil. The Kiwa River is now flooding through our farm. Only a minor flood at this point in time." Thanks for that, Leo. Get in touch, 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
And that widespread rain over the past week has been welcomed by many across the state. Patrick Fenton is a sheep producer near Balmoral in Western Victoria and says despite the incredible deluge he had on Wednesday, he welcomes the wet weather before a possible dry stretch ahead.
Yesterday morning, woke up at about 5 o'clock to pretty heavy rain, a lot of lightning and thunder. And I went out to check the rain gauge at about 6:45, and there was 50 mil in it then. So it was fairly heavy. And then by about 10:30, it was 70 mil. So then we had, we're 81 to date.
And that was only over the space of about 24 hours. Yeah.
24 hours, yeah.
That's it. That's a huge amount of rain at once.
Yeah, well, the first 2 inches were really in about 2 and a bit hours.
I mean, Balmoral, that's renowned for being quite a wet area at this time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I was talking to the fuel delivery bloke today, and we're about 15 k's south of Balmoral, a little area called Vasey, and we're on Vasey Farm, and he said it was much the same as that. When I told him we'd had 80, he said it's much the same in Balmoral.
And what does it look like at your place at the moment?
Well, all the all the big gully dams are full, and with the sort of inverted commas talk of El Nino coming back, I guess I'm sort of hoping for that, because at one stage when we had the 10 dry years, you know, from the early 2000s, I had one gully dam that didn't fill for 14 years. So it's nice to see them full if we're going to go into a dry year.
Any effect on the animals with 80 mils?
No, well, we were sort of a bit fortunate. I went out early yesterday morning through the laneways, and they looked to be, they were sort of on the fences, but they weren't stressed, and haven't had seen sort of any dead lambs or anything. So they'll be there, but you just stay away from them when it's cold like this. They can let them find their own shelter. We've got plenty of shelter belts on the property and lots of big red gums, so there's lots of protection for them.
It's also been welcome news for sheep and cropping farmer Courtney Lambert in the New South Wales town of Pooncarie.
Yeah, so we've had 55 mil. We had 20 Monday, and then, yeah, we had 25 Wednesday, and then last night in a freak storm we had 11 to top us off.
A freak storm, did you say?
Yeah, it was quite heavy, about 2 a.m. this morning, just come down quite heavy, and, yeah, we've got our crops in, so everything's popping up and everything looks good and green and healthy, and, yeah, lots of puddles.
So it's just the right amount.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, perfect. It's definitely given us a good start for the season.
But for Tom Scott, who has a hay farm and contracting business in Ravenswood South near Bendigo in central Victoria, it's halted work for the next few days.
Yeah, look, it's been wet, to be honest. We'd probably had enough, to be honest, before we had any of this rain in our country. We'd had a little bit going back a couple of weeks, and it was looking just nice. We're in granitic soil, which turns wet pretty quickly. So, you know, to have a average or below average year wouldn't bother us too much at all.
And so 78 mils over the past week, what does that mean?
It just means that we'll be staying off the paddocks for a little while. There'll be certainly no tractor work or anything like that. We did get some fertiliser out a few weeks ago on our crops, so we're probably lucky in that regard that we don't need to be doing too much, you know, in the immediate future. There'll be a little bit of spraying and stuff probably in a month's time once it hopefully dries out a little bit. We've still probably got another 300 or 400 acres to go, which is not a lot for some people's programs, but for us, we've got, you know, a lot of our work is small to medium size holdings, so it's still a little bit of stuff in front of us once it dries out enough to get on the paddocks.
That was Tom Scott from Ravenswood South near Bendigo speaking with Eden Hennanen. Rod Seach is a sheep producer and grain grower near Mulka, northwest of Euroa. He told Fiona Broom his paddocks are sodden.
I'm out in the tractor in the wet paddocks at the moment, chucking out a bit of hay because it's too wet to get the feed cart in here. We had 83 mils yesterday and last night, and we had 13 a couple of days before that, so 95 all up. I think they're forecasting another 5 or 6 tonight too, so that'll bring us up over the 100 for the 4 days.
Is that normal for your patch of the world?
No, not normal for June, no. No, definitely not normal for June. But anyway, look, half it would have been great. But it's just probably a little bit too much. But anyway, it is what it is. It's very flat out here, so the water lays here. Hopefully it'll get away fairly quick. We were fairly dry before this, so obviously it was welcome. I mean, 50 mils would have been great, but 100's probably a little bit too much.
So is this going to affect your season?
Oh, well, look, it'll set it up. There's no two worries about that. As long as we don't keep getting a heap of rain like we did last year. Like last spring was really wet. We got, I think October, we got something like 240 mils in a month. So it was way too wet, and it was wet all the way through too, probably from about this time onwards. But they are talking a dry winter, but we'll wait and see what happens in July, I suppose.
Did you actually have flooding last year, or it was just very, very damp?
Yeah, no, but there was flooding. There was a lot of flooding. Like I said, we haven't got any creeks for us. We weren't too bad here, but there was other gullies and that, where your fences get washed away. Leaves are blocked down in Longwood, and it's got creeks that go through it, and yeah, the fence has got smashed there. But we're not near any big creeks where you're going to get your houses or sheds or anything flooded. It's just hard on the stock, I suppose, when they're walking around in water all the time.
And in good news for irrigators, Scott Cornish from Southern Rural Water said the wet weather carried no risk of flooding, while it brought a welcome boost to storage levels.
Over in the east, Lake Glenmaggie is currently at 55% full, so there's still plenty of space for increased flows. But it is great to see some additional water coming into Lake Glenmaggie, which will increase water availability for the start of the 23-24 irrigation season. Also, further over to the west, we've got our Roslyn Reservoir, which is at 95% full, and that's expected to continue filling over the coming weeks and months. In our Werribee system, Pike Creek Reservoir is currently 87% full. Lake Merrimoo is at 86% full and Melton Reservoir is at 69% full.
That's Scott Cornish from Southern Rural Water speaking with Fiona Broom. Rainfall figures on the text line. Evan says, "G'day Angus, just 10 mils in Painesville over the past 48 hours. Certainly on the lower end of the spectrum there, Evan." This texter says, "35 mils at Dunkeld. 30 mils too much. We don't want any more rain for 3 months. Bring on El Nino." I just said that quietly so people in the drier areas didn't hear me. Chris says, "Hello Angus, we had 63 mils of rain for the week at the Homebush Recreation Reserve. That's 25 kilometres north of Balranald in New South Wales. Have a good weekend." You too, Chris. And yeah, 63 mils north of Balranald. Pretty unusual to get that much rain in that part of the world, I would imagine. Thanks for those figures. 0467 842 722 is the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
There were a couple of significant taxation changes in this year's federal budget that could have a big impact on farmers. They include the reintroduction of a cap on the instant asset write-off scheme and a new superannuation tax. I spoke with agribusiness accountant Luke Broadbent about the changes.
For businesses of over $10 million or less, the instant asset write-off is still available, but it's albeit at a reduced rate of $20,000. Prior to that, we obviously had temporary full expensing and the asset write-offs where there was an unlimited range there. So it's going to be a bit of a shock to the system going back to the general rates and pooling systems for a lot of people.
Up to this point, Luke, how useful has that been for farmers to be able to buy machinery and write off the full expense in that financial year?
It's been a huge advantage up front to get those big depreciation claims, but what it's essentially done is deferred a lot of the tax to future years. So what's going to be the case now is everyone's going to have to be careful when they're trading in assets or selling assets previously on the books that they need to be aware of whether it's been a pooled asset from years gone by or whether it's been immediately deducted over the last few years as to what the tax result will be.
Okay, so it's been a good thing, but it could cause some headaches if you're not careful down the track.
Yeah, that's right. I think the government knew what they were doing when they brought in the legislation that, there'd be a lot of incentivised spending at the time, and that's what it did. But, I think they knew at the end of it all there'd be a big recoupment of tax when people start the trading equipment down the road.
You said as well it will continue, but with a cap of $20,000. Are there any exceptions to that?
Yeah, so the primary producer concessions are still available out there for fencing, water and irrigation improvements and fodder storage assets, including hay sheds, where it's primarily and principally used for that purpose. So there is some exceptions there that still might be pretty beneficial to farmers, I suppose, but it's certainly not the all assets in at this stage.
The other thing is this new superannuation tax. I think that's an additional 15% tax on super balances of more than $3 million. Can you just explain how that could affect farmers?
Yeah, so certainly across our client base, we have a lot of farming clients who do have some land in their self-managed super funds.
And Luke, if I could jump in, would people have done that if maybe they're looking to lease out the farm, they put the farm into the super fund, lease it out, and then the income on that goes back into the super fund and is only taxed at that 15% super fund tax rate?
Yeah, so years gone by where farming land prices were a lot lower, there was the ability to get a lot more land into funds, and you're exactly right, there was concessional treatment on some of the lease money generated out of that. And there's sometimes two good deductions on the business side as well.
Okay, so back, I interrupted, but back to what you were saying about what this new tax, this extra 15% over for funds of more than $3 million, what would that mean for farmers?
Yeah, so as a requirement of a superannuation fund, that the farming land needs to be revalued every so often, 2 to 3 years, unless there's a significant market change as well. What's going to happen there is a lot of funds with farming land in it have increased significantly over the last 3 to 5 years, in general farming land has. So there's going to be a lot of funds out there that are now over these caps with the members involved. There's probably some planning opportunities before that 1 July 2025 to think about.
And that you mentioned that date. So this measure was introduced in this year's federal budget, but not coming into force for a couple of years?
Yeah, that's right. So it doesn't come into legislation until 1 July 2025. Obviously when we're talking large assets and moving them around, it's important to start thinking about those things now, and whether you can restructure if there is any advantage to doing that. So that should be done in conjunction with all other things, including succession planning, wills, updates, all those things as well come into play. The other side of that we're finding is obviously minimum pension rates with where members are in account-based pension pose. The pensions are far outweighing the leasing rates out there these days too. So we're finding a lot of funds are having liquidity issues as well, which is making all those funds come to decisions about what the farming land is and whether it stays in the fund or gets sold or comes out of the fund completely.
So given that and given this new superannuation tax, do you think there is going to be a big shift of farmland out of super funds?
I suspect so, yeah. I suspect just even that the liquidity issue is going to drive it a bit. But, certainly if you've got multiple parcels in the super fund and where you can get back under that $3 million rate if it's advantageous to do so, then that could be something that does occur.
Because these changes could mean pretty hefty increases in tax bills, couldn't they? Particularly if you have had, as we've seen in parts of the Wimmera, you know, a doubling, a trebling even more in the value of land in recent years?
Yeah, exactly right. So whether the interest rates and a bit of the uncertainty around the globe and whatnot does cool the market, I think it's already happening now. But, I suppose we're talking a longer-term thing anyway. So eventually property prices will probably increase again. But the other important thing to take into account, this is on the unrealised gain portion too. It's not actually selling the land. It's when it gets revalued as a requirement of the fund. So even if it does go up in price, it's going to be caught in this tax.
And Luke, just on that point about unrealised gains and those being taxed, could you just explain for the layman what that would mean in practical terms?
So in an example where a piece of farming land goes up by, say, $300,000 to $500,000 on a market valuation, which is a requirement of the superannuation fund after the point in time when this new tax comes in, there's certainly going to be some tax payable on that, but there's no sale or no realisation of the asset, so there's no cash available to pay that. The tax does get levied to the individual in the first instance, and then it can be nominated back to the fund to pay it. But it's just something to be aware of. There's going to be tax payable where the asset's still held.
That was Luke Broadbent, principal with tax consultancy RSM. 28 past 12, you're listening to The Country Hour. And the Victorian Farmers Federation is warning Victorians about the dangers of Q fever as cases continue to pop up around the state. Q fever is a disease spread to humans from cattle, sheep and goats and a range of other domestic and wild animals, and it can cause severe flu-like symptoms. Senior Farm Safety Advisor John Darcy says anyone who works with animals can be affected.
So we recently shared a post on risks of Q fever. It was brought to our attention by WorkSafe that there have been a few cases in recent times. Q fever is an issue that's perennial. It comes around from time to time. It's something that's always alive to the industry. But an increase in recent cases has prompted WorkSafe to reach out to us and ask if we can put out some communication to farmers across Victoria about the potential risks.
So on the Department of Health's website, it says so far there's only been 11 cases so far this year. Has this been in, you know, recent weeks, a rise in numbers?
The 11 cases is... and probably not a significant number, but it's not a good start either. And in communicating the messages now, it's really just to head off and try and ensure that we don't have further cases. Q fever can be pretty nasty, and we're just trying to be ahead of the game by just getting the messages out around what farmers need to do.
Are there certain areas of the state that are getting most affected?
I've heard that it's predominantly around Gippsland, southern Gippsland, and so mostly around that area. But the concern also the risk potential for it to spread to other regions across Victoria.
Has it been discussed as to maybe why this is happening?
As to why Q fever? No, that's the nature of it, unfortunately. It's a disease that pops up from time to time. It's not necessarily a known causation factor as to why we get increased cases, but it does relate to animal handling, and particularly handling of animal materials, carcasses and animal product. And so it's not just farmers that are affected. It's also those that are involved in tanneries, knackery workers, shearers, meat inspectors, dairy workers, but also people involved in the processing of meat product as well.
Right, so it's across the entire supply chain.
In the agriculture sector and those who are in the animal space, sheep and cattle, goats, yes, all of those sectors.
So it's not just cattle that are affected that people can catch this from?
Q fever is transmitted to humans from infected animals, and that includes cattle, sheep and goats, also potentially domestic animals as well, and wild animals as even possibly as well, kangaroos as well can be a transmission source.
And what are the notable symptoms of this?
The symptoms will be almost flu-like, and that's a problem in itself, and hence the need and the call for people to try and take steps to get vaccinated, because they may not be able to differentiate. But if people do become acutely ill with it, it's like an influenza-like illness, but can have longer-term health effects, and it can lead to pneumonia and also hepatitis.
How can people better protect themselves from this?
So immunisation is the key, and through our communications, we're encouraging farmers to try and direct their employees off to get vaccinations. It's something that VFF have been calling for some time for government to try and subsidise farmers to enable vaccinations, but that's a separate issue. But that's really the answer. Trying to direct and encourage their workers to go off and get the vaccinations through their local pharmacies. Yeah, that's probably the best preventative measure.
That was John Darcy, Farm Safety Advisor with the Victorian Farmers Federation, speaking with Eden Hennanen. 28-1, so let's head to news headlines now today with Callum Marshall.
Good afternoon, Angus. Friends and family of a seasonal fruit picker who was stabbed to death in northwest Victoria have spoken of their grief over the attack. Albury man Dale Newman has pleaded guilty to murdering David Gaskell and recklessly causing injury to his partner Karen Lyons in a violent home invasion in Menangatang last year. The Supreme Court heard Newman broke into the home to steal drugs and money, and that Mr. Gaskell died from stab wounds after confronting him. In a victim impact statement, Mr. Gaskell's brother Frank said he'd endured sleepless nights over the murder, while Miss Lyons told the hearing she had been unable to return to the property. A southwest Victorian man's had his prison term extended after prosecutors successfully appealed the 10-year jail term he was handed for lighting his housemate on fire. Umit Gaur Galu doused his housemate with petrol and lit him on fire amid an argument in Hamilton in 2019. He was today resentenced to 13 years jail by the Court of Appeal after three justices ruled his original decade-long term was inadequate. With time served, Gaur Galu will be eligible for parole in 2029. Unionised workers at Ballarat's most popular tourist attraction have decided against disrupting King's Birthday long weekend operations with protected industrial action. Sovereign Hill workers met yesterday to plan their next steps after a ballot showed 82% of respondents supported a strike of up to 24 hours amid a dispute with management over pay and working conditions. Union members have decided to suspend any protected industrial action until the staff-wide vote on Sovereign Hill's enterprise bargaining agreement offer is completed next week. Sovereign Hill is offering a 5% pay rise in year one, followed by 3.5% in years two and three, but the union is pushing for 7% and the reinstatement of penalty rates. Alpaca breeders say a one-month-old baby alpaca has been stolen from a Harcourt North property. The breeder at Milduck Alpaca Stud suspects someone stole the animal in the early hours of yesterday morning or overnight Wednesday. She says it will not be able to survive for long away from its mother. A cash reward is being offered for the safe return of the animal. And Angus, that's the latest in regional news. For more, you can head to abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Callum. Callum Marshall there with headlines. Let's head to the Weather Bureau now. Senior forecaster Alex Malitsis is on the line. Good afternoon, Alex.
G'day, Angus.
Alex, I don't know if the rain's moved away now, but last night in Horsham, where I am, we got another 5 mil. I thought it was sort of done, and then close to midnight last night, it started raining again.
Yeah, that's right. We had another cold front across the state overnight last night, and that reached the southwest coast late yesterday evening, and then slowly moved across Victoria overnight last night, and basically cleared the east this morning. So that gave us another burst of sort of generally moderate rainfalls in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning. We've broadly seen around 10 to 25 millimetres across the northeast ranges, although some of the high parts got around sort of 25 to 50 millimetres, and half of that would have been in the morning yesterday, and then the other half would have been overnight last night with that second front. Elsewhere in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning, we've generally seen around 5 to 15 millimetres of rainfall across Gippsland, southern Victoria, southwest Victoria, and also the central ranges, and less than 5 millimetres elsewhere. And since 9 a.m. we haven't really recorded any significant rainfall, although looking at the rainfall radar, I can see some sort of showers pushing into the southwest coast and along the far south sort of Wilson's Prom, and we are also expecting to see some isolated showers pop up across much of the state this afternoon, although generally fairly light falls for the rest of the day, Angus. And that's basically the story for the next few days. We see a ridge of high pressure move to the northeast tomorrow, and that'll start to direct more settled, milder northwesterly winds across the state, and we'll see generally sort of settled conditions across most parts over the weekend. Might be the odd little isolated shower in the southwest and in the Alps tomorrow, less than 1 to 2 millimetres. Otherwise fine and mostly dry tomorrow. And then on Sunday, we're basically looking at fine conditions across all of the state. Could be a bit cold in the east on Sunday morning, so we are expecting to see a little bit of patchy frost in the east on Sunday morning. Otherwise, looking like a fine weekend. And that continues into Monday as well, Angus. We start to see some north and northeasterly winds develop. And we could see the isolated showers along the ranges in those north and northeasterly winds, but mainly fine elsewhere. And it's not until next Tuesday that we start to see another front approach from the west, and that'll cross later on Tuesday. And we're expecting another moderate rain band with that. So at this stage, we're generally looking at around 5 to 15 millimetres across most ranges on Tuesday, although sort of more like 10 to 25 millimetres in the northeast ranges in the Alps, and generally less than 5 millimetres elsewhere next Tuesday.
Okay, so not a great deal to speak of for the northwest at this stage.
No, that's right. So we could see a little bit around on next Tuesday with that front, but at this stage, sort of less than 5 millimetres.
And just looking back at some of the rainfall figures, Alex, just going off our text line, it's not hard to find a text from someone saying that for the week they've had 100 plus mils.
Yeah, that's right. So there were many observations that had over 100 millimetres in the sort of the northeast elevated areas there. And actually many stations, sort of over a dozen or so, broke their June record, and some of those records go back over 100 years. So a very significant event a few days ago.
And just from my own memory, Alex, this is the sort of rainfall that I don't really remember us getting in winter. It sort of seems like in recent times it's been, to have such high rainfall totals, it's been something that's been more associated with spring or summer, and has contributed to flooding like we saw last year, but not so much in winter.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, so basically what we saw was a very tropical northwest or air mass move over us a couple of days ago, and that originated over the Indian Ocean, bringing that really sort of deep tropical air over Victoria. And yeah, it's with all those records that we broke, it's certainly not something that we see in June or have seen for a very, very long time.
But I suppose you said more another front on the way next week, but at some stage, if the dry outlook is to play out, we're going to stop getting those fronts, aren't we?
That's right. It's kind of a funny way to start our dry winter. But look, we have this front coming next sort of Tuesday and into Wednesday morning. And then beyond that, for the next sort of week, it looks like we enter more sort of typical conditions. So we might see another weak front cross the following weekend. And then, yeah, the outlook is still strongly suggesting that we're in for a drier, you know, much drier than average winter for most parts of Victoria.
Rightio, better leave it there. Thanks, Alex.
Good on you, Angus. Thank you.
That's Alex Militsis talking about what's happened for the week in terms of rainfall and what's coming up, including that front, nothing like what we've seen this week, but another front coming through on Tuesday for more so southern and northeast parts of the state. Not a lot expected for the northwest. Talking rainfall on the text line, Kai from Maiwi, I think hopefully I've got that right, that's near Tokemoel, has recorded, he says, "G'day Angus, 54 mils for the week here in Maiwi. Nothing has fallen over the past 24 hours. Tom at Trentham says, "G'day Angus, 100 mils for the week, 365 mils for the year to date." And Paul at East Baynton says, "Hi Angus, 86 mils since Tuesday, 98 for the month so far, and that is perfect timing," says Paul. Peter says, "A further 8.5 mils overnight, so 68 mils all up at Nullarvale. That makes it wet enough for this time of the year." Thanks for those texts. Keep letting me know how much rain you've had at your place, or text in on whatever you please. 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Australia's best shearer is in the air as we speak, jetting off to Scotland to compete at the Golden Shears World Championships. Daniel McIntyre from Glen Innes holds 6 national titles and was runner-up at the Golden Shears in 2005. He's part of a 6-person team representing Australia at the Golden Shears, which are being held at the Royal Highland Show in Edinburgh across the last weekend in June. He says they'll be competing in unfamiliar conditions.
A bit unknown what to expect with the sheep as far as that goes, but I'm definitely excited to be heading to Scotland here.
And that's it, a lot of unknowns. Do you know what sort of sheep you will be shearing and how they'll differ to what you're accustomed to?
Yeah, I've seen photos of them. But yeah, no, they'll be a lot different to what we're used to. Now we've just got to try and adapt as quick as we can and get into it.
And have they got much wool on them? Have they got much skin on them?
They'll be carpet wool sheep, so they'll be pretty bare around the legs. And that's a bit different to what we're used to with the merinos, but yeah, something different.
And will you get the chance to do a bit of shearing before the Golden Shears?
Yeah, we've got some practice lined up a couple of days beforehand. So yeah, we'll try and get a bit of gear going and go from there.
Because I guess it does put you behind the eight ball compared to the local competitors when it's what they're accustomed to shearing day in, day out.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it sort of puts us on the back foot, I suppose. You know, be same thing for them if they were to come to Australia, you know, the different type of sheep and that, just trying to adapt and sort of learn them as quick as you can.
Have you competed at the Golden Shears World Champs before?
Yeah, this will be my third time. First time was in Toowoomba, Queensland. Second time was in France in 2019, and this will be my third time, yeah.
And how were those previous experiences, and how did you get on?
Well, yeah, in Toowoomba, well, obviously we had the home ground advantage there. I ran second to Shannon Warnest in Toowoomba. That was back in 2005. And then in France, 16th I ran in France in them sheep there. So hoping to improve on that a bit this time, and yeah, see how we go.
And who are the men to beat, you know? Who are your main rivals?
Well, it'll be the Scottish boys. The Kiwis are always competitive, no matter where you go. Wales, Ireland. They'll be fairly competitive countries, I believe.
And, of course, the other Australian rep in the machine cheering, Nathan Meaney, who's a very very strong rival of yours as well.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, no, we'll be pushing each other along. I'm sure Nathan will do his best as well, yeah.
The road to this point for you, Daniel, you've got, I think, quite a fair collection of national titles to your name.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to win a few national titles and over the years, and hopefully a few more to come yet, but we'll just see how we go.
How many is it? Is it six, or what's the count?
Yeah, six. We're up to six, yep.
In sports shear, Daniel, what's the key for you? Because it's not a speed shear event, important to make that point. You win points, or you earn points for how cleanly you shear as well as speed. How do you balance up those two things?
It just comes down to practicing every day in the shed, and if you're not doing it in the shed, you'll never do it in the competition. So that's what I sort of love about the competition shearing. It's really improving the standard of the shearers out in the industry as well as, you know, us out there competing. It's good for everyone, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so your typical work, wherever you are, whatever you're working in, you're treating that, or you're trying to shear to the same standard as you would in a competition?
Yes, exactly, yep. Trying to shear to that standard all the time, and that way when you get up on stage in your competitions, it's just a habit then, and you go about your business.
And in terms of an experience, you're over there with the other Australian team, the likes of Nathan Meaney, John Daller in the blade shear, others as well. I suppose it'll just be a good experience regardless of how the results go.
Yeah, no, we're definitely looking. It's going to be a great time in Scotland, and looking forward to it, yeah.
That was champion shearer Daniel McIntyre, who's on the plane as we speak, I think, heading to Scotland to compete at the Golden Shears World Championships, along with half a dozen other wool handlers, machine shearers, and also blade shearers. On the text line, Rusty says, Angus in Southeast Australia, we are having one of the best starts to the year, but the Bureau keeps talking El Nino. The mutton, lamb and beef buyers use this weather forecast to lower their purchasing prices, although they are exporting record amounts of meat for huge profits at the farmer's expense. Thanks, Rusty. And Stephen at Yarrick, northwest of Kenaiva, says, Hi, Angus, a welcome 32 mils from this rainfall event, bringing us to a total of 154 mils for the year to date, and beautiful sunshine at the moment. And then Jared says, Hi, can you move on from endless and now boring rainfall texts and give us some rural content? Fair enough, Jared. There have been a lot of rainfall texts this week. And again, there has been a lot of rain as we heard Alex Militsis from the Bureau telling us, quite a few areas recording record rainfall for June. In any case, keep texting in 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Being a diesel mechanic has certainly changed over the years. These days, you've got to be able to fix a computer as well as an engine. With advances like autonomous tractors seemingly not far away, the appetite for apprentices is growing with the take-up of tech. Luckily, Gen Z is pretty tech-savvy, and at Melbourne University's recent Dookie Campus Food and Fibre Careers Day, the tech workshop was very popular with teenagers. Annie Brown spoke to Ben Evans, the apprentice coordinator for John Deere dealer Hoysler's.
Back in the day, mechanics were seen as grease monkeys. They sort of spent a lot of time doing mechanical repairs. Nowadays, our technicians, they sort of fight over if there's a mechanical failure, because engineering and manufacturing quality control has improved so much that we're seeing all these electronic issues, not so much of the mechanical failures. And so, of course, the way our target apprentices, we need those students, those bright kids that are tech savvy, and naturally, it doesn't matter what age they are. You can I've got children. Give my 13-year-old son. He can work out a smartphone, smart TV, anything within sort of 15 minutes. Where someone my age, in midlife, I struggle with that sort of stuff, and it's been a big learning curve, and that's what we're seeing in our workshops, our service techs. Yep, those guys, they can they can hear a noise in an engine and diagnose it without even pulling it apart. But you get them to, we're having to really spend a lot of time training them up to adopt the computer side of things, because with any technology to get introduced on equipment, we've also need to utilise the technology to diagnose it, and that's sort of where we're at now.
Do you have a big demand, I guess, for your apprentices at the moment?
Well, we've got lots of interest. Yeah. We've been doing a few of these career days, and there's a lot of interest in agriculture. And like guys, especially, didn't realise the amount of technology on some of the equipment.
Yeah. I guess when we talk about the future of technology and autonomous machinery, I guess a lot of people worry that might put people out of a job, you know, not having to drive a tractor anymore. Is that true, or is there any truth in that? Is it creating more jobs, I guess, with the maintenance as well? Like, it sounds like there's still plenty of work to be done, even if you're not in the tractor.
Oh, absolutely. Look, the thing is, farmers like to drive tractors. Yeah. That's one of the great things. You talk to any farmer, that's their quiet time. They get to sit in the tractor. They see what's going on their farm in that field. A lot of the time nowadays, there's multitasking. So the fact that they're auto-steering, they're in the machine at the moment, but they're on the phone. They might be in the harvester marketing their grain as the machine's going along. Now it gives them that time out of the cab if need be, and probably more so helping with the efficiency, that they're time poor. Farmers are time poor, so it means that they can actually, they might spend the day in the machine, but then at the end, come towards the end of the day, going through the night, they don't have to be in the machine. They don't have to employ an operator to be in the machine, but the job is still going to be getting done.
As someone in the business, how far away are we from seeing autonomous tractors and farmers having time off from inside the tractor?
Oh, look, John Deere, like the John Deere have goals, and look, they're probably one of their main goals are working towards like full rotation autonomy by 2030. So that's planting, any applications through the growing season, and then full harvest at full autonomy. A lot's got to happen for that to be envisaged, sort of thing. At the moment, we've got John Deere got prototypes in America. It looks just exactly like the tractor we're standing next to. It's got the cab, the steering wheel, everything's there, but it can also operate by itself. He can set it going by a phone. So again, we've just got to get that algorithm, so gather data to be able to adapt to different situations. It uses cameras and stuff to make decisions, but of course in any rural enterprise, we've got kangaroos, wildlife, things like that, so you've got to build up algorithms. So have the machine has to be able to understand what to then do if it does encounter some sort of object in front of it. So, yeah, we don't like to put a day, because if I say, we'll have it by 2 years, we'll have every farmer knocking on the door going, oh, I want to order one now and I want to get delivery in 2 years, sort of thing. We don't know.
What's the interest been like from farmers? Do you get a lot of questions about it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, because it's a way of becoming more efficient and cutting down their inputs, they're right onto it. Any of that sort of technology, they're not buying it for the novelty of it. They're buying it because they are running a business and they need to maintain and keep efficient.
That was Ben Evans from Hoysler's, based in Mildura, speaking with Annie Brown.
You're listening to the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Corallas and cockatoos are not always grain growers' favourite birds, because they eat grain and young crops. And farmers have tried lots of different ways to move them on, from scare guns to fake predators, often with pretty limited success. So what if there was a natural way to move them on that works and doesn't involve poisoning or other legal methods? Federation University ecologist Professor Rob Wallace has been working with miners' rest-based full-flight birds of prey near Ballarat to study if trained raptors can shift nuisance birds and reduce the damage they cause to agriculture.
Our idea is to have a humane way of overcoming the problem. And the humane way involves flying birds of prey, which are their natural predators, over them to disperse them somewhere else.
This particular study, describe what you're doing with these birds of prey.
Well, the birds of prey have been captive bred or hand-reared, and so they've been tame birds which have been trained specifically to fly over areas and to come back to the handler. And in their flights, they will disturb flocks of birds, which might be causing some damage. And these birds of prey don't actually attack the birds. They simply move them away to somewhere else. And if you keep flying them a number of times, hopefully the birds won't come back.
What are some of the examples, the species of birds of prey that you're actually using to do this scaring process?
There's several, and they're all native species, obviously. The peregrine falcon is one. It's the fastest animal on Earth. Very, very speedy things, which tend to work well in the open areas. Kestrels tend to work well in sort of wooded areas. We've used wedge-tailed eagles. We've even used owls. Owls flying during the daytime do seem to upset a lot of the flocks of pest birds because it's so unusual to have them flying around in daytime. So they're the kinds of birds of prey we use. Probably falcons and the eagle would be the most common. One of the best successes was actually at an almond farm up on the Murray River. Very large almond farm, very big enterprise. And corellas were coming in from their roost sites on the Murray River and attacking the almonds just at pre-harvest time. So the almonds are just about ready to be harvested. The corellas come through, they consume the almonds, they drop a lot onto the ground. And so what we would do is to fly an eagle from the roost site over the almond farm, and the bird would fly for a certain number of minutes and then be called back by waving a particular lure with a bit of food on it, and the bird has been trained, the eagle has been trained to return to the handler after a certain number of times. We might have allowed, say, 20 minutes of flight, might be 5 minutes of flight, just depends on the situation. And so you would do that, say, in the morning when the corellas are flying across to the almond farm. You'd do it in the afternoon. They tend to return late in the day to harvest the almonds. And after a week or so, you'd record how many corellas there are still causing the damage. And hopefully it's reduced. And then you might return perhaps a week later and repeat the thing again, by which time harvest has finished and you can stop the operation. Because the alternative, of course, is to gas the birds, to shoot them, to poison them. And these are, I think, quite deleterious to the environment. They're also inhumane ways of controlling a nuisance species.
I know that scientists like to quantify things. If you were to quantify it, how successful have these trials been?
Well, that's my role in this whole research. I'm a scientist. My colleague is the bird handler. And we're trying to get an ability to be able to tell landholders, if we do this, this and this, then the chances of success will be higher. So in other words, we've certainly had cases where the things hasn't worked or whether it's been too expensive to use. So by documenting the reduction in numbers and for how long the nuisance birds stay away, we're able to provide a better prediction of likelihood of success. So in some instances, there's been 100% success. For example, at some of the golf courses where the birds have been attacking bulbs underground, sort of little bulbs of grasses, kikuyu grasses and so forth, and tearing up greens. We've had some incredibly good successes. That almond situation was a good success. Others we're still trialling with less success, so we've got to keep trialling different approaches to try and enhance the success rate.
Not every farmer has access to a resident bird of prey. So if success can be replicated and your numbers stack up over a whole range of different uses, how could you see it actually working in an everyday sense?
The farmer would have to actually weigh up the pros and cons. It's not so much renting the falcon, it's renting the handler with the falcon, because you do need the properly trained ones. And it's happening now. There are cases going on right this minute of industrial complexes using birds of prey to disperse birds. Cockatoos, for example, can cause severe damage to rubber linings and electrical circuits and things like that and buildings. So we've used birds of prey for that. Not just golf courses, racetracks, sporting events have been used as well. So it's happening now.
That was Federation University Professor Rob Wallace speaking with Gav McGrath about using birds of prey to deter nuisance birds. Someone on the text line has an alternative suggestion. They say go onto YouTube and look at realistic remote-controlled birds being made now. You don't have to have real birds to do bird scaring. They can stay in the wild. Thanks for that. Barb also says, at Corak, north of Donald, our northern paddocks had 17 mils for the week. Southern paddocks, 25 mils. Lovely, but is it enough to tap into the subsoil moisture? We hope so. Barb also says, we're excited for everyone to get a big rain. That's a nice sentiment, Barb, I think, to end the country hour for today and for the week. And it is news time now, 1 o'clock.